Hello, everyone. This is David Hughes with the Corporate Marketing Group at Worldwide Technology. We are broadcasting today from the global headquarters for WWT here in St. Louis, and we'll be presenting our third episode in our Tech 37 Between the Racks series. In our Between the Racks series, we bring you a panel of subject matter experts here at Worldwide Technology to talk about a wide range of topics that are in the news in the IT landscape. So today we're going to be talking about a very interesting set of topics. First off, we'll kick off with how to really create a culture of innovation in your organization. A lot of companies talk about it, a lot of organizations talking about it, but it's not an easy thing to do. So our panel is going to discuss how to develop a culture of innovation. We're also going to be talking about something that is affecting cybersecurity. Is there enough IT talent? Is there enough people coming into the IT space in cybersecurity and other IT practice areas for that matter as well? We're also going to be touching on a couple of topics relating to the Internet of Things or IoT, and also different challenges that both customers or customer organizations and major OEM companies have in dealing with the relatively new multi-cloud environment. And we'll have a couple of other topics we'll throw in as well. So we think we'll really enjoy the discussion today. Hope you enjoy the panel. And on the other side, we'll introduce the WWT panel. So welcome, everyone, to the third episode of Worldwide Technologies Between the Racks, part of our Tech 37 program. And as I mentioned earlier, we have three distinguished WWT experts, subject matter experts, to talk to you today about a wide variety of topics that I think we put together, which will be of interest to everyone. So we've got Joe Weber, Kent Noyes, and Tony Berg. So maybe starting with Joe, could we just kind of go down and just kind of tell us about your role here at Worldwide and what you do?
Sure, thanks. Joe Weber, I'm a principal solutions architect on our business development team focused around cloud and automation.
Kent Noyes, I'm a principal architect in the global security practice.
And my name is Tony Berg, and I'm the Vice President of the Chief Technology Advisor Group.
Okay, thanks, guys. So I don't think we'll have any problem having you guys speak up for the next 35 minutes or so, I'm sure. So I think everybody get a chance to get a word in edgewise. So let's jump right into it. So one of the topics that came up when we were kind of looking at things to talk about is one thing that Worldwide stresses, and a lot of technology companies do, honestly, is just to establish a culture of innovation and really be an innovative company. So there was an article we saw where the person who wrote the article had kind of a different take, and their take was it's impossible to foster a culture of innovation. It's a waste of time. So maybe just kind of starting with you, Tony, kind of like from your perspective, how do you foster a culture of innovation? And obviously, I assume you think it can be done. And assuming that, how do you foster that kind of culture?
Yeah, I absolutely think it can be done. I think the big hurdle that some companies have is you got to have two major things. One is you got to have a good culture to start where people can be free to have ideas and try new, you know, solutions or architectures. The other hurdle that a lot of organizations have are a place to actually go and innovate. They don't have an area, they don't have the facilities. And so at Worldwide, we really strive on building that foundational culture, but also have our Advanced Technology Center where we can almost go and try things that we might fail at five times, but it's that sixth time that you really innovate something new that changes the game and makes that particular customer or Worldwide in general more effective or that much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kat?
Well, I disagree with the fact that, you know, the idea that you can't create a culture of innovation. I think you can do that. I did agree with the point in there about focusing on business outcomes. I think that is probably, I'm completely in agreement with that. I think I'm 100% on board with.
And that was one of the points the author made.
Exactly, right. One of the points in the article. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that is accurate. I think as technologists, we get distracted by technology that's cool, and we want to innovate for the sake of innovation, just to find something, some new way of doing things with new innovations that are out there. But on top of that, you have to do a lot more. If you aim at nothing, you're going to hit it. So if you're not thinking innovation, you're probably not going to go there. You're not going to get there. So I think you can do it. As he states, a good facility to sort of facilitate that. Think about it. And failing often and quickly, I think, is another element.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
Yeah, I agree. I think if you have the opportunity, you know, within an organization to take the time out and actually have some time, not just on your free time, but actually during during the normal, you know, business hours during the day to actually innovate. I think you can. I think you can foster that. I think it starts with the right people, though. And that's something that definitely Worldwide Technology has strived to get the right people on the right seat on the bus is typically what we talk about. Another thing I will say, it's just having a culture of innovation sometimes doesn't always get you to an innovative spot. You also have to have leadership that is actually driving that down as a necessity of part of the company culture. Another thing too, it does take personal pride in your work, in what you do, in order to innovate. You have to be able to fail fast. You have to be able to keep trying things and never give up.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that customers do is they try to make an innovation group. And innovation usually is a whole bunch of little things pushed together to make a truly innovative idea that they might not be able to do with a small subset of people. You have to get ideas from a lot of different people mm-hmm. because it's usually pieces and parts that have to come into the overall innovative solution.
Right. So it's not enough to just kind of form a group and say, hey, this is our innovation group, and just expect things to grow out of it organically. Yeah. Right?
I think the ability to take little chunks of small pieces of innovation and be able to integrate or string those together, it really does provide a place and an environment when you have those little innovations and a sharing of the knowledge like we have here to actually do that. We do provide a culture of innovation and the ability to innovate. And it's actually promoted here. So it's definitely something that I would also disagree that you can actually mm-hmm. foster that.
And maybe as a follow-up, and we kind of really didn't discuss this beforehand, but you know, as you guys were talking, I was wondering, just in your experience, whether it's OEMs or whether it's customers or other organizations, do you find that a lot of organizations, at least right now, do not have that kind of culture? I mean, do you think it's more the exception than the rule that the company, I know they talk a good game, but do you find a lot of organizations, at least right now, really still don't have that kind of culture?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the old adages, when you're a kid, there's no dumb questions. When you innovate, you got to be open to every idea. And you can't just snap back on somebody and say, that's really dumb. We would never want to do that. Because that could be the key piece to a series of innovations that actually makes it work. And I think where people struggle is probably that foundational culture. And it might be in certain groups, but it has to be from the top of the organization down through and allow people to bring ideas on any topic up. And then that's what starts to foster the innovation, because it's usually not the first couple. It's the 10th, 12th, 15th mm-hmm. idea that makes really a difference. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, kind of moving on to our next topic, and I know this is kind of one of those things where I guess two things can be true, that there are obviously a lot of people getting into IT and getting into technology in terms of careers, occupations, you know, matters of expertise. But on the other hand, because there is so much growth, every organization is just, you know, expanding their budgets, their resources, hiring. Is there a shortage in some areas of technology for these types of professionals and types of experts? And the one article that we saw on this actually made the point that is the case in cybersecurity. So maybe I could have, so Kent, maybe you could talk to that, and then Tony and Joe, maybe talk a little bit about some, you know, kind of expand that to some of your practice areas. Are you kind of seeing that too, that, you know, it's growing so fast that there is maybe a shortage of people moving into those areas? So Kent, I'm going to start with you.
So I agree, there's absolutely a shortage in the cybersecurity world, and I think you'd get that feedback from any research firm you look at. We see those statistics all the time, any hiring firm. We talk to customers every day, different customers almost every day, and it's always about security with me. And that is the number one issue that pops up. They're trying to do more with what they have, and it's difficult to find qualified individuals to do that kind of work. Security is growing really fast, and it's got a lot of complexity wrapped up into it. The attack surface is constantly moving. You have mobility of users, mobility of servers. You have cloud, public cloud environments you're trying to secure right now. Your attackers are more sophisticated. You've got more tools than I've seen in any technology area I've been in at Worldwide Technology in my career here. So there's just a whole lot of complexity there, and the industry and the resources for it haven't quite caught up, so it's hard to find people to do that, and we tackle it with a mix of you know, education is important. The industry is trying to educate and get specialists kind of ramped up in it. But we also have a heavy focus on security automation to help organizations. It's a daily conversation with them to try to help them do more with what they have, to move a little bit faster, can up processes, automate them and sort of offload those and move on to something else so they can move a little quicker.
And to piggyback on that automation piece, kind of my focus here around cloud and automation, there's definitely a lack of skill set out there around automation, specifically around infrastructure automation. It's kind of a new up-and-coming thing for a lot of customers as the rise of infrastructure devices having open frameworks, REST APIs, and things that can be used to be hit programmatically to do the thing we used to do manually on those same devices. So we see this quite frequently at customers that they know they need to automate to move to the next level to provide either a private cloud or interact with a public cloud in a more holistic fashion. And we do see a lack of folks in the industry with that level of skill set to meet the demand.
Yeah, I'd say it's really just the evolution of IT. You know, the folks that have been in around for a while, back in 2010, things were done very silo. You could be a network person to be highly successful. Mm-hmm. Nowadays with cloud, you have to know a lot of different areas. And so there's folks in the IT world that are experienced that probably had a history of being in one group for a long time. And a lot of the new people coming out of college have a broader gaming background that, where they might understand more of the technology, but they don't have that experience quite yet. So there is just a gap in there of individuals that can talk about multiple technologies together, because that's what the customers are really struggling with. They have the experts. When you got to start to connect them together, either through automation, security frameworks, you really have to understand all of those different pieces to make it a viable solution for the customer.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of as a follow-up to that, are you seeing that with a lot of the automation services that maybe right now are helping organizations deal with the fact that they don't have a lot of, you know, staffing, internal resources to do it, so they've got to go the automation route? Do you kind of see where companies might start thinking, well, you know what, maybe I don't have to worry about, you know, staffing up and getting experts in here because we can go the automation route? Do they kind of see that as more of a long-term, so, well, we're not going to worry about staffing up as much?
Well, I think from my perspective, it's not that they are, it's an effort, they have no choice.
Right.
You know, they have to get, if they receive thousands of events or alerts in a given day from a security perspective, and they can only process four or five of them in a given week, there's a problem there from an investigation perspective. And all the other processes that they have going on day to day, so certainly within the security realm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the automation helps, but the other thing that you really have to think about when you're automating is you are putting a lot of things together. And so you might have a great automation engineer, but they got to understand, how do you secure that automated? How do I get audited so that one person can't create something, deploy something, and delete something all at the same time? Because those are the things that automation will help. You might see some cost savings, but the trend in IT is every year we get a bigger budget, we acquire more workload, but we probably add a couple people to the environment. So what's automation has allowed us to do is keep up with the trend and actually be more innovative to new solutions for the company, because a lot of the daily tasks now are covered by the automation that's happening.
Mm-hmm. And to tie that into your previous question is the skill set, right? So that's what customers are kind of clamoring for. We need more people that have these skill sets. A lot of times you won't find somebody that has that infrastructure background and an automation background. What we see customers doing is embedding some developers with some coding experience, scripting experience in with the infrastructure folks to kind of expand that out and move the ball forward quicker. There are folks out there that have both, but we call those kind of the unicorns, right? The ones that are out there that do have that level of experience, that understand the complete stack of infrastructure like Tony was talking about, but also have the ability to integrate those together programmatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as much automation as organizations may have, they still need that personal skill set, I guess, to both set that up and then also to monitor it.
And I think there's another piece of this too, which is also marrying all those integrations up in with the actual use case or business process that specific customer has. And without that corporate knowledge, infrastructure knowledge, and also the integration knowledge, without a complete life cycle and understanding that, you're going to come across a lot of challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the customers are stuck, to your point. Either they need help making the automation to start, or they might have got an idea of what they want to do, but they don't have the resources to actually take care of it once a partner comes in and actually builds it, and then they leave. There's nobody that knows how to fix if a script or something goes wrong.
Right.
So they're kind of held hostage a little bit right now on their ability to advance based off of skill sets.
Mm-hmm. So more kids need to get in IT.
Yeah,
it is. And try to learn more things.
Yeah.
Moving on to our next topic then, something that we saw that looked like it was interesting was about IoT, surrounding IoT. And there was an article that was had some quotes by, you know, one of the top practice leaders at Cisco. And his theory was that most IoT projects fail due to a lack of experience and security. So I guess kind of to throw this out, maybe I'll start with you, Joe. So kind of agree, disagree with that, you know, perhaps. And maybe more than that, what do you think the challenges are for organizations when they want to implement and deploy IoT projects?
I think the first one is security. As you start looking at endpoints, just securing endpoints, as you look at IoT and you start making, you know, different lights and other things part of your actual network, how do I secure those? Mm-hmm. Right? Without the security a part of that, now my attack surface went from, you know, tens of thousands of computers to hundreds of thousands of different endpoints, computers included, lights, you know, generators, whatever. And without securing those, you're not really securing your infrastructure. So that would be the very first thing I personally would look at when I went into an IoT project. How am I going to secure either the IoT network, but also provide the availability needed for the IoT devices to run effectively?
Okay. Ken?
So the issues I see there, we're talking about IoT, particularly in manufacturing and the enterprise world. There's two different organizations, right? You got the IT organization, then you have the OT organization. The OT is the one that manages the IoT environments, essentially. And they are two different organizations. They have two different areas of specialty. And, you know, the OT guys are developing the IoT architectures, and they don't have a lot of the IT experience, which includes security and those architectures wrapping up in it. So they often will sort of silo their solutions and have trouble supporting it sort of on the back end once it's created, even architecting it properly. So we always encourage communication. We run this all the time, trying to get those groups to talk together any way we can. Also, the IoT devices often, you know, for cost-cutting purposes and just the age of them, often come in with no security provisioning built into them. They're trying to strip it down and keep it kind of lean, so there's not a lot of security built into it. So they need that extra, from a security perspective anyway, that extra security architecture sort of wrapped around it, and that takes the skill set of the IT guys to be able to do that. So those are the issues I see.
Okay.
Yeah, they made some great points. I fundamentally, with any IoT, it's a sensor, so it's got to be secure. It's got to be put on some network to get back. And then what you've done now is taken your environment from 10,000 devices to 100,000 devices. Mm-hmm. You're going to be collecting a significant amount of data that you're going to have to do some type of analytics to actually make decisions to use the IoT sensors or whatever happened to be there. And some of the platforms have that, but it's really, I think, where people fail is they don't really look through the whole life cycle of how do I get it on my environment, how do I secure it, and then how do I actually take that information and do something of value to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, I think a lot of, you know, our listeners, people that might be watching this, they I think consumers are kind of getting used to hearing about IoT in their home, like with, you know, your whole home appliances and cars and everything being wired. But obviously we deal in the enterprise world. So I guess, is there anything like what are the one or two big challenges? And I know we kind of touched on a little bit already, but kind of in the enterprise space, what are the one or two big considerations that I think have to be made? It's like, okay, we really want to try to move into an IoT environment.
Scale. Everything nowadays gets an IP address, from air conditioners to buildings to heaters to, and so in order to connect it, to take care of it and configure it, it's on a network, and it usually has a series of sensors in it, or IoT devices in it. The other thing is, if you just think of like the cars we drive, you no longer do take it to an auto repair shop and somebody looks at the carburetor. It's somebody plugs in a laptop and they're looking at hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of sensors. So everything made today is that way. When you get to an enterprise, just the scale of devices that they have getting data out of, and they have to make sure secure before they get deployed, really can make that an overwhelming proposition for them.
I think it's a little bit of taking the analytics that you gathered from things like maybe a heat sensor inside of a rack to you know, how much power consumption or whatever you're looking at from a data center, but taking all of that and actually applying some analytics to it, like you said, Tony, and getting some real contextual data out of it, and then performing some action upon that. That whole life cycle of data ingestion to action on the output, or something, some action on the output, is very important. Otherwise, you're just putting in IoT just to put in IoT. You really need to gain something from your IoT. You need to come with a business outcome of what you're trying to achieve. Then just let's throw some more endpoints out on there, because it's something that we've heard, like customers, we've heard we need to do this. Well, what is your business outcome?
There's been some cool stuff too. I mean, it's really going to change the world relative to that. I mean, like cities, for example, put them on their trash cans nowadays, and instead of just going on a route every day and picking up every trash can, they now save money because they go to the trash cans that are full. And they almost map out every day the route of the individuals to go pick up those trash cans. Well, you can just imagine in a big city, gas, cost of people, cost of maintenance on the trash trucks or whatever that is. So if people start to have that business reason why and get started, they'll see the value of IoT, and then they can really start to figure out, how do I use it to help my business either grow or save money?
And then that's why data analytics is going to be so important, and is so important for companies in that are trying to do that. Well, kind of moving on to the next topic, and it's kind of related to what we talked about a little earlier, was how, again, speaking of enterprise organizations, a lot of them are moving into the multi-cloud architecture, the multi-cloud space. And on one hand, there's some people see that as a benefit. There's a lot of benefits to that. Something that we were looking at the other day was, there's kind of another take that every person, you know, in the company can almost be like their own cloud manager. Everyone can be their own CIO. So that, you know, that potentially could be a liability. could be something that's, you know, not a benefit. So I was kind of wanted to throw that out and get your take on that, in terms of kind of the risks and or benefits that companies are going to get into when they move into these more multi-cloud environments. So Joe, maybe throw it to you first.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a lot there. There's a lot to cloud, as I think probably a bunch of the people watching this will probably understand. But if you look at what cloud represents, it represents some freedom for lines of business that maybe aren't getting what they need out of their own IT department. From an IT perspective, it also is a risk for them by not being able to provide the same level of service. What we've seen is customers really want to get through all the IT processes. And I'll give you an example of this. We had a customer in here not too long ago, about 2 weeks ago, that really what they were looking at was a 3-week cycle just to spin up a workload for some developer to build something on top of. We need to take that cycle of, you know, that length of time, we need to shorten it very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And maybe using automation, which we talked about before, shrinking that cycle down to minutes, if not tens of minutes, to provide better, more iterations of those workloads, of that development, so we can continue moving that application, which is most likely a lot of times a revenue generating thing these days with IT, move that application to the next level and to the next level quicker and quicker. From a CIO perspective and making every person their CIO, we saw this a lot, and we've seen this a lot at customers where with the CIO or somebody, a senior director, says, okay, lines of business, you're allowed to go use Amazon, Azure, Google Cloud, whatever it is, and go out and freely use that. Well, once they get back after 6 or 7 months, they start consolidating the bills. This is the wow factor, right? Because cloud is a service, and you will pay for that service as well. Really what we see is customers, at the end customer of the IT departments, they want that cloud-like experience, whether it comes from Amazon, Azure, Google, or their internal IT. So we've seen a lot of customers, and Tony and I have been talking to a bunch of customers around, how do I make that Amazon or Azure or Google Cloud-like experience on our own private cloud, but also be able to utilize the same features and functionalities of those public clouds?
Yeah, Kent, you have some thoughts from a security standpoint?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's the fact that they're utilizing it, it's just a natural progression. It's a new, well, relatively new innovation that if a business unit sees a way to move faster and do business faster, they're going to take that path, right? So they're going to utilize the cloud whenever they can. They're going to become their own CIO. You know, if I owned a business where they were doing that, what I would want to have is visibility over that. I need to be able to control cost and risk and speed of business, and I want to know what's going on. The IT organization itself is trying to actually, you know, they're in a constant state of trying to keep up with that, trying to broker it as fast as they can. So there are solutions that pop up that, you know, can kind of help that, provide that visibility, provide that security around it from a security perspective. Cloud access security brokers are common solutions that are popping up now that have APIs directly into the cloud providers, as well as being able to examine the data as it exits at the perimeter points within the organization. Data loss prevention mechanisms, SSL decrypt to be able to decrypt encrypted traffic to the cloud so that they can see what the users are transmitting back and forth, because they want to know where their data is, right, going to the cloud. So there's a lot of issues around that right now. But, you know, it's not a good or bad thing. It's just a natural thing that's happened because if they can move faster, they're going
to
do it.
Something we got to deal with.
Yeah.
Or they have to deal with.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tony?
I think those were all great points. The other challenge that they're having is it was easy at one point. So a lot of people go to Salesforce. They'll go to Workday. They'll go to Azure. And when you start, it works fairly well, right? And it can work when you get to a multi-cloud environment. But when you're in IT, fundamentally, you have to think about how the application is going to be served up, where is it going to get its data, how is the security applied, and if you get too many clouds, what can happen is your web piece can be over here, your application can be running over here, your database can be running in a different one, and now you've created another set of challenges that make that environment just as difficult as if it's internal. So I think where customers are looking at is more and more of the software vendors are developing cloud-enabled platforms or applications. The lines of business purchase usually the applications. What they're trying to figure out is how fast can I get it from my internal side and how fast can I get it from some type of public or cloud environment. If those two were closer together, most people will naturally probably stay internally because they'll think of all the security. But the gap is fairly large in a lot of organizations, and what IT is trying to do is bring that gap closer together to make sure they're always going to have a multi-cloud environment or a hybrid type of environment, but what they're trying to do is close that gap so that they can pick maybe some things that have a high security risk to stay internal. Others, it might absolutely be something that you can take out to the cloud and it'll be there forever.
Mm-hmm. I mean, quite frankly, if you look at it, what the lines of business want is they want literally the push button, get banana for what they want. I mean, realistically, that's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
They want to push a button, they want a banana pop out.
Who doesn't?
So, I mean, yeah, that's what IT organizations are looking mm-hmm. to do is creating buttons. And one thing that we've always talked about for a long time, and one of the things I talked to a lot of customers about, in the future, there's really going to be two types of IT people. There's going to be button creators and button pushers, and there's a significant difference in pay between those two. So
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
Well, actually, just that this conversation kind of leads into our next topic because, and kind of staying in this multi-cloud environment space, is we kind of talked about it from a customer standpoint, but also there's the OEM organizations, kind of their how it relates to them. So we here at Worldwide work with, you know, a lot of major OEM partners in IT. You guys all work with them probably on a daily basis. So I'm curious to hear what you guys think about how they're reacting to, how they're responding to, and kind of how they are, not surviving is not the right word, but just how they're working in this multi-cloud environment, especially working with other vendors. So maybe Tony, you can start with you.
I think it varies by manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Some are saying it's not going to happen, it's going to be more internal. Some are really embracing it and making sure that whatever platforms or products they're making are open to work with as many of them as possible, so that no matter what the customer chooses, they're going to be part of that architecture or that solution. I think that's one point. The other point that I think the OEMs sometimes look at and then other times don't is going to all these newer technologies are fantastic. The technology will work, but it really comes down to how do your people take care of it and what are your processes to use it. And when you're deploying something internal or in a cloud, those processes can be very, very different, and how do you have to execute that? And so I think OEMs that have tried to keep as open as possible and work with as many options as possible are going to be successful. And the ones that couple that with helping the customer understand how they're going to have to transform their people and their processes in either one silo or a broader subset of the IT department are going to be the most successful in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kent?
So I think, you know, avoiding single points of failure is sort of IT 101, and that article is kind of about that. You know, if the storage vendors and the other ones, they're going to integrate with cloud, and they're not going to integrate with just one because, you know, our customers do not want to be completely reliant on that solution. That's an inevitability for them to integrate with the cloud. They don't want to be locked into a single public cloud provider. It needs to be multiple. That's 101 in IT, and from a security perspective, you know, we face that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
So I think there's some vendors and some of our strategic partners that we have here at WT are starting to look at things like NFV or network function virtualization, mm-hmm. trying to virtualize their platform into something that can be ingested or put into a cloud. Another thing that we see as well is that software is king when it comes to cloud. So software products usually can be adopted or transformed into a cloud environment a lot quicker than anything from a hardware perspective. We've noticed that as well. So I think those two things are going to be key for our OEMs to look at moving forward. The rise of containers are also very advantageous to moving fast and being agile. So those things coupled together, the OEMs that are doing those types of things are really pushing the needle. From a customer perspective, what we do is when we talk to customers, I've heard this a couple times, they're not even going to look at an OEM unless they have an open, documented API, usually RESTful API of some sort, because of the way that they're moving into a more programmatic environment. So that's very key for our OEMs to understand, is that you need to have whatever you can do normally to the device, you should be able to do programmatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a great point. There's not one OEM out there that solves everything. Mm-hmm. You can't go to one public cloud and get everything mm-hmm. that you need. You can't go to one internal OEM and get everything. So it comes back to, they have to work with other platforms, they have to work with other clouds, they have to work with other people. The more and more you're locked down and you're closed, less people will buy your product because it's harder to connect to it. And then it creates proprietary coding language that becomes extremely difficult for somebody to keep up, because not because they don't have the skills, mm-hmm. it's the pace of change. We go so fast in IT now that if you're not open, and it's not look like a lot of the other things that we're connected to, you're going to have problems keeping that up to date, keep the firmware, which long term becomes a security risk because it doesn't get patched, it doesn't get updated, and it kind of starts to snowball on itself.
I mean, I know it's hard to probably put a percentage on it, and I was just going to ask a question about, you know, we kind of talked about what OEMs can do to be successful in this multi-cloud environment. And I was going to ask, like, from what you're seeing, what are companies who are kind of struggling? What are some of the things? And Tony, you mentioned just in terms about being closed. So, you know, is there like one or two other things that, you know, do you see like a pattern of, you know, that OEMs were struggling in the space? Do you kind of see like, okay, well, you know, here's like one or two things that they're not doing or things that they're struggling with, and this is why they're really struggling in this space? Is there kind of some consistency among the OEMs that are struggling in this space?
I think what started to happen, you know, technology, like flash storage, network devices, they've all started to get to be pretty close to the same speed. Mm-hmm. So now the challenge I think that some of the OEMs are having is over the years, probably through the 2000s, 2010 era, they had to get really wide to have a lot of products to sell, but they're only good at a handful of them. And the ones that are consolidating back down to really focusing and being really good at a handful or a couple handfuls of really strong product areas are gonna be successful, because just having too much, they have to do the exact same open, cloud, secure across all those products, which takes development cycles, which takes people, versus can you go faster because I have, instead of 30 things, I have 5 things that I have all my people focused on, really innovating and making it game-changing. Because I think what also changes customers is newer technologies and features that change the way in which they can serve technology up. The only way an OEM can stay up with that is having a lot of people work on it and start to stay ahead of the trends, things that they're seeing, and ultimately executing on it.
And I think Tony made a good point, and another one to add to that is unifying their portfolio across the board and having their portfolio at least, at the very least, integrate together through an open API that anybody else could potentially integrate with it. We've seen some of our, even our strategic OEMs, that will actually close themselves off from some of our other strategic OEMs, which actually causes a lot of friction. And customers see that. They're not blind to that. They see some of those things going on, and it's customers are going to go towards an OEM that has the openness, willingness to work with other OEMs out there as well, and to provide a holistic solution. And to Tony's point, for OEMs out there, they really got to work on what they're really good at, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Well, we just kind of got a couple minutes left, so we always kind of like to have a last kind of wrap up question. So, and I'll just kind of throw this out to everyone. So, is there kind of one topic that maybe we haven't covered, or something that you're kind of seeing, you know, that's, you know, whether it's in the news or something that you're hearing from customers or that you're hearing in the space that you think that, you know, here's something that, you know, we need to watch out for, or here's some things that maybe we don't know right now, or, you know, that we are going to know about soon. So, Joe, we can start with you.
I think one of them, and it's been around for a little while, but I think it's starting to get a lot more adoption, is the serverless architecture or function as a service. That idea of only running specifically a job when it's needed and only being charged for it from a cloud perspective, mm-hmm. The way that can potentially be a cost savings to our customers is going to be a big one.
Okay. Ken?
I think, you know, I mentioned security automation earlier, but I think if I was going to mention one other area that's huge in security right now, it's segmentation.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many regulatory compliance demands being placed down upon, and it's just a growing list. Combining that with best practices and already, you know, internal pressure to secure the environment. You know, we have organizations who I think had sort of back up and start again from a segmentation perspective. They're starting all over with risk assessments and data classification and reincorporating all the controls that they need in to do it properly again. So kind of seeing a huge movement in there and a lot of customer activity anyway.
Okay.
I heard a good stat the other day, and I can't remember if it was Gartner or IDC or Forrester. It was one of those three. But what they said is by 2019, customers will pay 3 times the current hourly rate for a very good confidant, trusted advisor, somebody that can help them. Because if you think of large enterprises, there's just a lot going on. And it moves extremely fast, you know, with things like Uber, Airbnb. Mm. They're getting threatened.
Kind of gives you a headache kind of after a while.
And the problem is they have to stay up with that pace, because if they don't, they lose customers. Mm. Well, the landscape has just, it was private, now there's cloud, and there's mm-hmm. SaaS. So they need people that can really help them understand, where do I go, how do I get started, and really become somebody that they can rely on helping them through that transformation.
Okay. All right, great. Well, yeah, there's definitely going to be a lot more of that coming in the future, I'm sure. So, well, that wraps up our third episode of Between the Racks. So, again, I want to thank Joe, Kent, and Tony for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You guys survived your first visit into Between the Racks. I'm sure you'll be back, right, if we ask you again, which I'm sure we will. And to our viewers, hopefully you enjoyed our conversation today. If you haven't, please check out our first 2 episodes. They're also located on YouTube. And we also release this on a podcast platform under Tech37. It's available on iTunes. It's free. And it's also on all other podcast platforms that you might subscribe to. Also, please check out our Tech17 podcast channel. It is also available on iTunes and our other podcast platforms. So thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time on Between the Racks.